Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 9, in which Hannes Hagström joins Jörn Schottenberg, Louise Campbell, and me to discuss recent work on in-office scanning, impact of different diatypes and patient prognoses, plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress about patient identification and screening along the clinical care pathway. This conversation starts with Louise Campbell discussing a recent publication of a pilot study from Armandi et al., including Jörn Schottenberg as a co-author, evaluating the impact of short-term dietary gluten reduction to reduce metabolic dysfunction. Now, that sounds a bit backward to me, but reduced dysfunction is the way the study defined it and Louise described it. The study shows that even a short-term intervention can have a meaningful impact on CAP scores. This confirms Louise's experience with sugar-rich foods, suggests to her that several different diet interventions can produce valuable results. Each can produce valuable results. It leads to a discussion with Louise, Jörn, and also Hannes Hagström, asking which change actually drives the lower CAP, gluten, associated high fructose and sugar content in the gluten-rich products, or overall calorie reduction. To Louise, the most important idea is that interventions work best with frequent VCTE tracking and multiple diet options for patients to choose the one they can execute most efficiently. Jörn and I concur. It's striking how fast new research around issues of patient treatment and therapeutic options are stacking up, and how the number of questions grows even faster than the number of studies. This conversation covers several points, but it's pretty strictly focused on treating the right patients the right way, at the right point in time, with the right agent. So, just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Louise Campbell.
The piece of research, actually, that interested me recently was a piece that Jean's involved in, and it was Angelo Armandi and your team doing the short-term reduction of dietary gluten improves metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic disease, a randomized controlled proof-of-concept study. Now, you use the CAP here, and over a very short period of time, you saw quite a reduction in the CAP, which is what I tend to see when we talk about interventional therapy. And yes, any device that probably measures steatosis can do the same, but you see the behavior change and then pick the right part of a diet to change in people. And a lot of gluten-rich products are those products that are sweet, donuts, biscuits. So when we talk about changing the sugar content of somebody's diet, I looked back at a client that we have who's done this. When they drop the sugar out of their diet in all shapes and forms, biscuits, sweets, cakes, particularly apple pies, they drop their liver fat. But when I read this study, was that because they removed gluten, or was that because they removed more of the high fructose and sugar content, or was it a bit of both? Because it was really quite marked, 1.1 kilo weight loss and defatted from 275 to 230 within 6 weeks. So I was really interested in this little piece of work that I picked up, Jean. So you might be able to tell us a little bit more, because it does focus on the CAP rather than kilopascals.
Jörn Schottenberg.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that study. That's a single center intervention we did. I try to offer all my patients something, and the ones that do not qualify for clinical trials based on advanced MASLD, typically I don't want to send them off to the primary care physician. So we've done all types of dietary interventions over the past, and gluten reduction is one that actually is simple, because you have a lot of gluten-free dietary products in the stores these days. It's sometimes easier than if I start to discuss, you know, the protein, fat, carbohydrate content of the diet. And so we did this as a proof of concept. The ups and downs of CAP, we used the SMART exam, so we captured a lot of CAP readings here, not the 10 readings like it used to be in the days, is that CAP has a little bit more variability, of course, than the elastography, the VCTE, I think. But a robust reduction, particularly reaching 30%, is something where we do believe in the change in intrahepatic fat content. And I think this is how we're going to deal with it in real life practice down the road. The patients are going to go on a diet, on an intervention. We're going to do a fibro scan. It is a prognostic biomarker based on what Hannes and Vincent Wong and co-authors have shown. And we use it to guide us on treatment response. Now, there's some pitfalls to that related to BMI and variability of the reading as we have. But as you have the opportunity to read a patient, do the scan over and over again, I think this is a very elegant way of doing it, in particular if you're able to see other biomarkers go the same direction. You can pick the weight, you can look at the transaminases, all things that we're going to be able to do. And I think this is the way we're going to be dealing with resdifra too. We'll use those simple biomarkers to assess potential treatment response.
Hannes Hochstrom.
So Jan, I haven't gone through that paper in sort of detail, but congrats to it, of course. But we did maybe a similar thing. And I think the thing we learned that it's more about the calorie intake that can be reduced when you switch a diet. Did your patients also in the active arm then, you know, lose weight? And was it the effect on CAP? Was it mediated through the loss in BMI in general? Or do you think it actually was that gluten content that was the bandit here?
Yeah, that was our hypothesis based on actually preclinical models supporting that gluten does cause some innate immune stimulation. In particular, not gluten, it's a subfraction of gluten's the antitrypsin inhibitors. And I have to say a limitation within that study is we do not have in-depth assessment of dietary intake. So I cannot give you the details of caloric intake of the individual patient.
Which is also very, very tricky to measure also because you need to trust what the patient is telling you in a questionnaire, and that's super tricky to remember what you ate 2 weeks ago, right?
It's one of those tricky things in lifestyle interventions. I agree. However, we did train them to a healthy diet and repeated that in a telephone interview. So they had two trainings within 6 weeks. So there was some cutting down. It was not weight effect alone that we saw. And there was a small difference in weight, but we didn't find that the BMI meets a short study period too. It's only 6 weeks really. And it speaks to some of the challenges also to maintain, you know, those are not people that are gluten sensitive in terms of developing disease, obvious disease. So their motivation to avoid gluten is even more difficult than gluten avoidance. It's very tricky. In that short term period, we didn't see a weight difference. I think it comes down to, as Luis said, some of the content of the diet being less carb rich and bringing some of those contents down.
Exactly what I was thinking also. But I guess it's a nice way of showing, like, if you really want to do a gluten-free diet and you think you can adhere to it for a very long period of time, then might be beneficial for some patients.
I think, Hannes, what it also shows is that people will change parts of their diet. They may not record it in a clinical trial level of input, but they see a change. That change modifies behavior. That behavior then becomes more consistent. And I think for the real world population, outside of the big clinical studies and the big FibroScan studies going on in Europe now, which are all going to be patients more than real world. Whereas when I do real world, 33% of our Australian cohorts and people just walk through the door, they've all got fatty liver. Very few of them have got NASH, but they've got fatty livers. They want to see that reduction in fat. They want to make a change and be able to get a quantitative improvement. If they're working with a dietitian, if they're working with a physical therapist, if they're working in a gym, we can now reflect some of this, and the data's there to say that we can see it. And I think, can we put more of this into primary care? Can we take this out and make a change to squeeze, I suppose, upstream to stop people getting to MASH? Because we can now tweak little things and show them the difference. That's what we're now getting to with the non-invasive therapies. And that's the big win for the resmetirom approval and no biopsy, is that we are now going to look at all of the other NITs to be able to say, oh, what can we gain from it? Patients don't respond on the whole to a blood test. So this physical factor that they see, they love. And I think it helps.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That is sort of some sort of biofeedback, right? That you have when you do an intervention and then you see a result. So my takeaway here was just mostly that also when you do an intervention, you know, some people are very motivated to do this intervention for some time. But unfortunately, if you say that this is the only solution that will work, and then people are going to try it, and some are going to fail, unfortunately, and they're going to feel bad about it. But if we can show that there are actually multiple dietary things you can try, okay, maybe this didn't work for you, but try this or try this, then we're in a better position, I think, because then people can choose a little bit what suits them. And I think the important thing in the long run is having a sort of a sustained weight loss and not doing this yo-yo thing, which is probably quite harmful, actually.
I think it comes down to the individual preferences and what the patient can adhere to. I mean, it's not that gluten-free diets are the solution for MASLD, but it shows you it works. And I actually went back to the publication, Hannes. They do have a different BMI in the end, and there are multiple ways that you can do that. I think you can give them a simple tool. They can self-implement that. It's helpful. And we have those metrics for the NITs to measure up these. days.
Roger Green.
I think this is fantastic. So first of all, for those who don't listen to this podcast all the time, you know that we always adhere strictly to the outline that we start with. We didn't start with much of an outline today, but we've already blown it to smithereens in the first 23 minutes. I like this conversation a lot better. But the point I was going to make, you're jumping off what you just said, is that the more control you can give a patient over their own therapeutic regimen and the direction they're going to go, the better you're going to do. People do well what they do well. They do poorly what they do poorly. So the more diet choices you can give, the higher probability of success you're going to have in a mass population, because people will have more ways to go to succeed, and some will be easier for them and some will be harder.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page in which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's topic, but we've got two ideas and they're both great. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.